Admit it. Our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them, and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com, and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. Own a bookstore? Sell guns at the show? Get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to a dollar a piece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. Streaming live at ScottHorton.org. And NoAgendaStream.com. Monday through Friday from 11 to 1 Texas time, noon to 2 Eastern. Well, we're not on Thursdays at No Agenda. But anyway, the rest of that is true. You can find the whole interview archive there at scotthorton.org, and you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow as well. All right, so first guest on the show today is David Vine. You might remember we spoke with him last week about that great Tom Dispatch piece on all the money in building the bases of empire. All the money lost, I should say, in building the bases of empire. He is an assistant professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C., and he's the author of the book Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia. He's working on a new book about military bases overseas in general, which, in fact, there's a great section worthy of Chalmers Johnson on that subject in the book Island of Shame already. And, by the way, Island of Shame is now out in paperback. Is that correct, David?
That's right. Thanks for all the kind words, Scott. It's great to be back.
Hey, man, that book is just something else. It's just such a horrible story, and you did such a great job tackling it and explaining what's going on there. And you've done it again in this piece at the Huffington Post, 40 Years of Heartbreak, Let the People of Diego Garcia Return to Their Homeland. And that's not just a figure of speech in this case. The heartache bit there. Why don't you tell us the story of, well, I don't know how to say it. You say it and then tell us her story.
Sure. In the piece I've written, I focus on the story of one Chagossian who was born in Diego Garcia, the island where the United States has a billion-dollar plus military base and has had it for now more than 40 years. I tell the story of Orly Talat, Lisette Orly Talat, who's been something like a Moses to the people of Diego Garcia, the Chagossian people, among other Moseses, now that they've been in exile for more than 40 years. I tell her story of exile, which includes the experiences she's suffered, suffering what Chagossians call chagrin, which means profound sorrow. It comes from the French le chagrin. It's part of their Bantu and French-based Creole language. And it's not just a metaphor, this profound sorrow, this chagrin. People describe members of their community dying of chagrin, dying of profound sorrow, of sadness, of a broken heart. And yet, and at first I thought it was just something of a metaphor, you know, a figure of speech. But when I was doing research with the Chagossians over 4+ years now, even longer since my book has come out, I started asking them about this heartbreak, this profound sorrow. They told me of case after case of members of their community dying of heartbreak in exile. And it turns out, many people, in other displaced groups and indigenous groups, actually the elderly in many contexts who are forced into nursing homes, we see similar reports of people dying of a broken heart, essentially. And there is now increasing medical evidence that those sorts of displacements, those sorts of intense shocks can change our physiology, can damage the heart literally, not just metaphorically. The claims of Chagossians dying of a broken heart in exile, dying because they can't return to their homeland because they were forced from their homeland, are not just exaggeration or metaphor. It increasingly looks like there's concrete medical evidence to support their claims.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, Diego Garcia is basically the main island in this Chagos archipelago, correct?
That's right. It's the largest island in the Chagos or Chagos archipelago, which is about 56 islands in total.
And so if people were to head, due east from Somalia and due south from India somewhere and met out there in the middle of the ocean somewhere, that's where we're talking about, right?
That's exactly right. Dead center, almost dead center in the Indian Ocean, quite isolated, 1,000 miles from the nearest landmass, which is India. And in fact, it's interesting that you say if people were to head east or head south, there are people who head out there. There are people who have yachts.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be white people who have yachts, Euro-Americans, Europeans, New Zealanders, Australians. And they're allowed, actually, to go to the archipelago and often stay there for weeks at a time, not at Diego Garcia, but at what are referred to as the outer islands, the other islands where Chagosians were born and raised and grew up and created communities.
Well, because it is like the last Shangri-La, right? It's paradise on earth. It's one of these things you only ever see in a postcard in your real life.
That's exactly right. And you can actually look online and see the photographs both from the outer islands and Diego Garcia, which is also thought of as a paradise, and members of the U.S. military refer to it that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gorgeous tropical island.
All right. Now, so one of the things that just really blew me away about this, and I guess this is the same in a lot of different, really for any indigenous population anywhere. I don't know why it stands out to me so much here, but just the story of the Chagosians and how they were slaves, or their ancestors were slaves, I don't know how many generations back. They overthrew their masters, they homesteaded those islands, and like straight out of John Locke's textbook or something, they made this property theirs. They owned it, simple as that, in the purest kind of a way, right? Former slaves.
Well, it's a little more complicated. You're absolutely right that they were, they arrived in what were previously uninhabited islands as enslaved laborers from Africa, and as later indentured laborers from India joined them and created over time a population of mixed ancestry. They gained their freedom both from slavery and indenture in the 19th century, but the islands remained plantation societies. But for plantation societies, the Chagosians, that is, earned an incredible amount of freedom, and I think largely because of the isolation of the islands, they gave them much better bargaining power, essentially, against those who controlled the plantations than plantations elsewhere in the world, in the Americas, in the Caribbean, for example. So they enjoyed incredibly generous, in a certain sense, work benefits. They had salaries and cash and food. They had regular vacations. They got housing benefits, education, basic health care, and a range of other burial benefits and other benefits. And most importantly, they did, I think, as you were suggesting, exert sort of communal control over the islands. They were the ones who were there for generations, the plantation owners and the plantation managers. They were there for just, you know, periods of time, and then were rotated out periodically. The Chagosians really developed a kind of communal ownership over the islands, even if, you know, the plantation owners would say, no, we're formerly the owners. The Chagosians exerted
de facto control.
Well, I
guess I had thought that the foreign ownership of the plantations had ended up winding down after they didn't have the slave labor and the former control, and that the former slaves became the masters of all the land, but not each other. No?
No, there might have been some isolated cases where a few sort of went to even smaller islands in the archipelago and lived there largely in isolation. But the plantations did continue after the end of slavery and indenture. But I think, as the core of what you were suggesting, that the Chagosians really exerted control and ownership of these islands is exactly right. And most importantly, they felt like this is our homeland. This is the land of our ancestors. This is where I was born, where my parents were born, my grandparents were born. This is where, as many of them say, my umbilical cord is buried. They felt a deep connection to the land, just like many indigenous people do around the world.
Yeah. So then, when the Brits gave it over to the Americans for, what, fistful of beads or something like that, they were basically already, they already claimed, quote unquote, imperial ownership over the entire archipelago at that time, or up to and including that time?
That's right. The British had controlled the archipelago as part of colonial Mauritius since the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the beginning of the 19th century. They did sort of turn over Diego Garcia and actually rights to build military installations over the entire archipelago to the U.S. government for $14 million, a secret $14 million payment that was made in a way to evade congressional and parliamentary oversight. But it's interesting that you bring up the issue of control of the islands. British control is actually now being challenged by the Mauritian government. Mauritius gained its independence in 1968 in some ways because of the Chagossians' exile. But Mauritius is now challenging British control over the Chagos Archipelago because essentially the archipelago was separated from colonial Mauritius as part of the independence process, which is explicitly against the UN's rules on decolonization. So the Mauritian government is now challenging that in front of a UN court in The Hague, and that case will come up next year.
Well, and yeah, so let's talk about some of these court hearings, because I think you write in your article that they were doing pretty good in the British courts up until they got to a high enough level where it mattered.
That's right. I mean, it did very much matter in the three quite amazing victories they won in the British High Court in London. Three times British judges ruled their expulsion unlawful under British law. But then in each case, the British government appealed. In 2008, the case went to the highest court in the UK, and by a 3-2 ruling, the court found in favor of the government for the first time. And this, of course, was heartbreaking to the Chagossians. They were so close to fully regaining the right to return. They appealed that ruling to the European Court of Human Rights, and waited and waited and waited for years. And finally, at the end of last year, the European Court ruled against them on basically on procedural or technical grounds that they didn't have standing to bring the suit.
They didn't have standing. Yeah, because they'd been kidnapped.
Very well put. Very well put. Yeah, it was again, heartbreaking defeat for the Chagossians, but the important thing to point out is that they have very much not given up, and I don't think they'll ever give up their struggle to return.
Yeah. And this is the 40th anniversary, you say, right?
It's the 40th anniversary of the final deportations. The deportations took place over about 5 years or so between 1968 and 1973, and May 1973 was when the last deportations took place.
Man, it's a nightmare, too. I may have screwed up the thing about how free they were at the time that they were re-enslaved or whatever, but one thing that I certainly remember well out of the book is the picture painted at the last few days there, where all the dogs were rounded up and shot in front of their owners, and all the people were forced at gunpoint onto the boats. It's just like the Georgians and the Cherokee, you know, marching them off to Oklahoma kind of a thing, only out in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, it's very much in keeping with, unfortunately, a sad, really horrific history of displacement that, unfortunately, our country has carried out and the U.S. military has been a part of repeatedly. But I think it is important what you were suggesting about the Chagossians. They were really living in freedom in their homeland. I don't know what picture people have of plantation societies. Often they're very restrictive. This was not like that. They were living in freedom in what they considered their land, their homeland. And as one Chagossian put it to me, life there, you know, was not rich in a strictly financial sense, but it was rich in every other way. It was, as this one Chagossian put it, the sweet life that they enjoyed there.
Yeah. Well, it just seems so unfair, too, that is, I mean, it's sort of too obvious, right? That, okay, so then they turn it into a thermonuclear bomber base, and sometimes they torture people there. But if you're a billionaire, then you can anchor your yacht and hang around for a couple of weeks and play Gilligan's Island and whatever. But the people who are from there, they're not allowed anywhere near it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There have been fishing boats that some Chagossians have been part of that have been turned around when they come near even the outer islands, let alone Diego Garcia. Whereas if you're a, you know, white-skinned person who owns a yacht, you can, as you said, play Gilligan Island for weeks at a time. It's just another part of the racism that underlines this whole sad story.
Yeah, exactly. Well, why don't you talk a little bit more about that, because you do give that a bit of a treatment in your article here. And again, everybody, it's David Vine, the author of Island of Shame, now out in paperback. Please read. It's such a great book. It's such an important story. And you know what? It's so horrible that makes it that much more unfair, really, for how unknown this story is. You know, this should be a real big deal. And instead, it's basically a big deal to David Vine and to the victims. And so, you know, these people deserve better than that, you know? They deserve to have their story known. Anyway, you got this piece. It's at the Huffington Post, 40 Years of Heartbreak. Let the people of Diego Garcia return to their homeland. And talk a little bit about the history of the, well, come on, we're talking about the Brits and the Americans here. They might as well be the German National Socialists when it comes to dealing with the brown, the southern hemisphere of this planet.
I guess I would just say I really appreciate your the energy that you bring to this story, because I think you're exactly right. And the outrage, there just aren't enough people in the United States, especially, who know about this history, who care about the history, who care about what our government did. The United States government came up with the idea to create a base on Diego Garcia, but demanded in negotiations with the British that they get the island and all the islands without any indigenous inhabitants on them. They paid for it with that $14 million secret payment, and they gave the final expulsion order. The highest-ranking admiral in the Navy in 1971, when they started building the base on Diego Garcia, sent a literally three-word memo to Diego Garcia. It read, "Absolutely must go." That was the final deportation order to complete the deportations from the islands. On the positive side, there are people around the world who do care about the Chagossians, who have been working with them, struggling with them, supporting their struggle for decades now. And there are a growing number of people here in the United States who know about the story, but still, as you said, not nearly enough. It's not seen as a story. I've had, you know, members of the press here in the United States tell me that. There's no story here, as if the people's expulsion and their everyday life in exile is not worthy of space in the press. And it's gotten next to no coverage in the United States media as a result. And so part of my hope in writing this piece and in writing my book, Island of Shame, and all the writing I've done about the Chagossians, is to try to bring it to the attention of especially the public in the United States and to politicians in the United States who have the power to make this right, to make up for an injustice that was perpetrated against the Chagossians. And it really wouldn't take much. They're not asking for the base on Diego Garcia to be removed. They're just asking for the right to return to their homeland and some proper compensation to compensate them for what they've suffered in exile, for having their homeland taken from them, for all they've suffered since the deportations. And, you know, that we're talking about a population that now numbers around 5,000. It would take a very small amount of money, especially compared to the literally billions of dollars that the United States has spent on Diego Garcia since the base was built. You know, it would take the wing of a B-2 bomber there, probably to you know, put the Chagossians back in a position. You're never going to make up for taking someone's homeland and everything that has happened in exile, all those who have died of heartbreak, like Lisette Talat and others. But some fair compensation could at least provide some recompense and some matter of justice to the Chagossians, and that's what needs to happen.
Yeah. Now, on Matters of Race, when you did your the research for the book, did you find the N-word in all the documents here, there, and everywhere else? Because that has been a big part of it. In this article, you quote the military calling them Tarzans and Man Fridays, but it must have been worse than that, too, huh?
I think actually that was a British official. U.S. officials were a little more careful in the documents I saw, and of course there are many documents that I haven't been able to see because when I've made Freedom of Information Act requests, they get turned down on national security grounds or other grounds. There are of course documents hidden in archives. One of the offices that was responsible for the expulsion, apparently their files burned. Part of the Navy. So there's a lot we don't know, but whether they use the N-word or not, it's clear that racism is a major part of this story. And actually, one of the officials, Gary Sick, who the one time Congress looked at this in 1975, they held one day of hearings, and Gary Sick testified for the Defense Department for the Pentagon, and I spoke to him as part of my research, and he said, in looking back on the story, that essentially it was sort of a 19th century or 20th century thought process. It was, as he said, colonial thinking after the fact about what you could do to a colonized group of people, to a group of people with brown and black skin. And of course, all the players who carried out and ordered and orchestrated the expulsion were white, Euro-American folks in the Pentagon and the State Department, and British folks in their government. So it's impossible to ignore the racism that's going on here, and it becomes even more obvious when you look at the pattern of displacement that begins with Native Americans being displaced on this continent, and I was able to trace other cases just since 1900 where the U.S. military has displaced local people as part of the creation and construction of military facilities overseas, and was able to document at least 17 cases in which the U.S. military has displaced local peoples, mostly indigenous peoples, and I think without exception, or almost without exception, these are people of color being displaced. We can think of Vieques, Puerto Rico, a quite well-known case, people in Okinawa who were displaced, including some who were displaced all the way to Bolivia, of all places, thousands of miles across the Pacific, people in Thule, Greenland, and the list goes on and on.
Well, in your book you talk about, as we spoke about on the show, a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, about the Empire bases there. You talk in the book about how the Empire itself knows good and well, and of course we can always find the quotes here and there where they admit it, that the Empire bases is what causes the blowback that gets American civilians killed. And so, geez, guys, maybe we need a better way to do this than have lily pad bases all over Eurasia like Mackinder and all this old, 19th and 20th century nonsense. Maybe we should just threaten the entire planet with nuclear holocaust from Guam and Diego Garcia. And we already got rid of, I guess, the people of Guam. I don't know how much protest they can put up. The people of Diego Garcia, well, they don't really exist anymore, so that won't be a problem. And the whole world knows that we can get a thermonuclear bomb to your town in like 45 minutes and at least. And so why even occupy the whole world? This is forward thinking, right? This is the best kind of intelligence we can get from our military. It's like, Chalmers Johnson's right about blowback. We need to just threaten them all from Guam and Diego Garcia. So that speaks, I think, to pretty poorly for the future, assuming that they're bright enough to listen to those people saying that, I guess Air Force guys. That speaks very poorly for the chances of the Chagossians that they'll ever get their islands back. That's apparently going to be the last base they give up.
You're referring to some people in the high-ranking officials in the Air Force who their dream is to be able to hit any location on the planet from basically three bases, Guam, Diego Garcia, and a base in the United States. What you see the Pentagon doing time and again is pursuing multiple strategies simultaneously. So I think while people in the Air Force, you know, have this sort of fallback plan to be able to hit anywhere on the planet from three bases, just in case the United States military gets kicked out of every other base overseas. At the same time, they're sort of covering their bases, so to speak, by building new ones, by building the lily pad bases you referred to in a growing number of places around the world, especially in Africa, in East Asia, and in Latin America, so that if you get kicked out of one place, you've always got somewhere to fall back on. And one of my concerns about these lily pad bases, these small, generally isolated bases that try to keep separate from large population centers to avoid the kind of opposition and protest that we've seen from the people of Diego Garcia, from people in Okinawa and elsewhere. The problem with these, they sound better than, you know, massive bases in Okinawa and Japan and in Germany. But the problem with the bases, like we saw in Diego Garcia, a base can get pitched to Congress as a small base, a lily pad base, or as in the case of Diego Garcia, it was just going to be an austere communications facility. Mm-hmm. Those bases can then be the nucleus for a much larger base, which is exactly what we saw in Diego Garcia. The Navy had plans to expand it beyond the so-called austere communications facility from the beginning. And basically what they did after they got the first appropriation was just steadily work to get more and more money, and over time the base, you know, went from austere to multi-billion dollar base. So that's one of my concerns about the proliferation of lily pad bases around the world, that those so-called small lily pad bases can, you know, in a few years or decades become much bigger.
All right, everybody, that is David Vine. He's an assistant professor of anthropology at American University in Washington. He's the author of Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia, which is now out in paperback. Please read it. It's really good. It's got a whole treatment of the Empire bases in there, too. And you can read him at tomdispatch.com and at huffingtonpost.com. The latest is 40 Years of Heartbreak. Thanks. Over at AIPAC, the leaders of the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., they're constantly proclaiming unrivaled influence on Capitol Hill, and they should be proud. The NRA and AARP's efforts make them look like puppy dogs in comparison to the campaigns of intimidation regularly run by the neoconservatives and Israel firsters against their political enemies. But the Israel lobby does not remain unopposed. At the Council for the National Interest, they put America first, insisting on an end to the empire's unjustified support for Israel's aggression against its neighbors and those whose land it occupies, and pushing back against the lobby's determined campaign in favor of U.S. attacks against Israel's enemies. CNI also does groundbreaking work on the trouble with evangelical Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia and drumming up support for this costly and counterproductive policy. Please help support the efforts of the Council for the National Interest to create a peaceful, pro-American foreign policy. Just go to councilforthenationalinterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page. And thanks. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Every month, Plumline Individualist editor Sheldon Richmond brings you important news and opinions on policy by heroic FFF President Jacob Hornberger, hard-hitting journalist columnist James Bovard, and others from the best of the libertarian movement. The Future of Freedom tackles the most important issues facing our country, from the bankrupt and insane welfare and regulatory states, to foreign wars and empire, the dismal state of our economy, and ongoing assaults on civil liberties. This society needs peace and freedom for prosperity to prevail. Subscribe to the Future of Freedom in print for just $25 a year, or online for $15 a year, at fff.org/subscribe. And hurry up! Because this summer they'll be running my articles about the wars in Libya, Syria, and Somalia and the future of freedom too. That's fff.org/subscribe for the future of freedom. And tell them Scott sent you.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. There for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey guys, I got his laptop.